There once was a retired minister from Arkansas, and most of you will know that that's where I'm from. And he spent his career on the old sawdust trail, the tent meeting preaching circuit that was the ancestor of television evangelists. And to give you some context, his congregational home, when they claimed him, was called the Apostolic Church of the Divine Christ in God, a fellowship which broke off from a splinter group of a sect whose name includes all the same words but rearranged in a different order. His theology was influenced by the truth-telling, even wild-eyed Hebrew prophets and their understandable thunderings against idolatry and corruption and the sins of the flesh. And he mostly left out the stories of Jesus. In fact, his religious thinking jumps right over the Gospels and lands squarely in the book of Revelation. It was well known that the minister only preached one sermon, and that he'd gotten away with it for the 45 years of his ordained career because he was always moving from one tent meeting to the next. If the circuit happened to bring back to him the same town again, he believed that a person who'd been saved by his sermon the first time would not be in the audience the second time around. And if someone did return and stay, the preacher figured that the sermon had not done its work before and that the person clearly needed to hear it again. His single homily was about the rapture, the esoteric doctrine held up by those who wait for a coming apocalypse. But it's a belief system that's especially meaningful when this life was too painful to bear. You can hear this same longing in the disciples' questions of Jesus in the scripture today as they look for clarity in a world turned upside down. Gaining wide acceptance in 19th century America, a time of slavery and war and unsettling change, the rapture speaks of the second coming of Christ, when all true and faithful followers will be plucked up wherever they are, wherever they happen to be at an unexpected moment, and taken to the kingdom, live and whole. Now, on this minister's Buick LeSabre, the preacher had a bumper sticker which read, "In case of rapture, driver will disappear." True. I can talk about it because I'm related to these people. In the sermon, he paints a dozen verbal pictures of people gathered together in various places from which one of them, and it's always only one, would disappear without warning. People are waiting in line at the supermarket, and all of a sudden the checkout girl is gone. The rapture. Kids are sitting at school, and without a hint of what is to come, a seventh grader in the second row vanishes. The rapture. Folks are shopping at Sears, and suddenly the guy standing in the auto parts department is simply gone, leaving behind his two brand new snow tires. He won't need them where he's going. The rapture. All of this, of course, is designed to scare the daylights out of the listeners, most of whom, upon brief self-evaluation, count themselves as those who surely will be left behind. Now, one Sunday, he was the guest preacher at Christ Episcopal Church in downtown Little Rock, where portions of my family have been members since the 1930s, and he was in rare form, I'm told. Most of the congregation was scared to death by the time he finished speaking, when he slumped in his chair, sweating and exhausted, like he had run a race. Now, the choir at Christ Church is made up of 8 ladies and 1 gentleman. That's the entire choir. I just want to be sure you understand. It's not like the other people are not nice. There are only 8 people, right? Plus one. And it somberly recesses out of the church during the closing hymn, right? On this particular Sunday in November, however, the narthex was crowded with donations from the Christmas bazaar, blocking access to the parish hall. So if the choir walked down the center aisle, they'd have to keep going right out the front door and into 30-degree weather. So instead, they exited their pews by marching across the chancel, just as if it were here, behind the communion table and going out the side door. This is a direct but narrow path, and it has one hazard: a wooden heating grate in the floor placed directly behind the communion table. Now, the grate measures 2.5 feet square. We have just some that look just like them in the chapel, except this one is wooden. It's made of pine, and it rests in the hole in the on the floor that opens to an industrial-sized heating duct below. Do you see where this is going? The duct goes down 3 feet and then bends at a right angle before continuing on its way to the old hot air furnace. Now, Emma Bowers was a new soprano in the choir, and she was wearing shoes that day with little heels. And as she passed over the heating grate, her right heel went into one of those little square holes, and it lodged there tightly. After 2 strong pulls, in which the shoe stayed on and the heel stayed stuck, Emma lifted the whole grate, which wasn't so hefty, and right out of the duct, and she kept walking along as if she'd been shot in the leg. And she acted as if nothing was strange. Right behind her was another soprano, Sarah Jane, who, to put it kindly, is not keenly aware of her surroundings. Do you hear what I'm saying? She can see well enough, but she doesn't seem to notice things. Meanwhile, the rest of the choir is lurching forward in time with Emma Bowers as well as they could. And at that moment, the guest preacher looked over, and just as he looks behind the altar, Sarah Jane goes down.
Oh, my God.
She gave a little squeal and disappeared from sight right behind the communion table. Now, as you can imagine, the preacher was slack-jawed. His eyes were wide, and he dropped his hymnal, "The Rapture!" And he was still there. In about 4 seconds, which seemed a lot longer, folks realized what had happened, and someone went to Sarah Jane's rescue, and the preacher breathed a sigh of relief. I'm told he gave up preaching about the rapture after that. But look, when life is too painful to bear, let's be honest, we imagine an escape. When will we know that the end is about to come? The disciples asked Jesus in the gospel, and well, they should. What will the signs be, they wonder. And we can chuckle at their naivete, but apocalyptic thinking still surfaces today, and not only in Arkansas. We're alive again in a time of hopelessness. I heard it in the fear-mongering that accompanied the last presidential election. I wonder about it when people tell me that they've lost hope in young people, or that they've lost hope in the government, or that they've lost hope in the church. I wonder about it when 20-somethings come to me and they say that they don't plan to marry and they're not planning to have children. And I wonder about it when we argue about fossil fuels and climate change instead of altering our behavior. Someone's world comes to an end somewhere every day. And there is plenty of anxiety to fuel doomsday thinking around the world and across our town. Thoughtful people still wonder if the end is near. And you know what? In a sense, it's always near. So we don't have to be the kid on the long car trip who keeps asking every 10 minutes, "Are we there yet?" We're there. And I think we know it. Look carefully and you see the disparity in our schools. Look carefully and you feel the perversion of the spiritual and economic legacy of racism. Look at our wounded environment. People are hurting. They're dying. And when they lose hope and turn cynical, we can't just sit idly by. Rather, we can respond. We have to respond to John the Baptist's clarion call. God's kingdom is at hand. It's in our hands. Kathleen Norris writes, "The literature of the apocalypse can be scary stuff, the kind of thing that can give religion a bad name, because people so often use it as a means of controlling others, instead instilling dread by invoking a scary notion of God. But apocalyptic literature, like the reading from Luke today, is not a detailed prediction of the future or an invitation to withdraw from the concerns of the world. On the contrary, it's a wake-up call, one that uses intensely poetic language and imagery to sharpen our awareness of God's continuing, abiding presence in and promise for the world. God's here, and people are hopeless and dying. And when we look carefully, we discover that marriages and families and communities, even nations, often come together and discover their true strength precisely when some apocalypse, some new revelation of the fault lines in our thinking or our system occurs. For some reason, we seem to learn best how to love when our hearts have been broken open, when our plans fall apart, when our myths of self-sufficiency and goodness and safety are shattered. Apocalypse is meant to bring us to our senses, allowing us a sobering, if admittedly painful, glimpse of what is, and then to envision what might be. A new day, a new life, one that we can build from the ashes of the old. Who knows when Christ will come, or when or where? When we're in search of a timetable or try to crack the code of apocalyptic literature, we're probably on a wild goose chase. And when some of us claim that everybody who joins my group will be fine and everybody who doesn't join my group will not be, well, we're mistaken. In fact, the ones who will be saved, Jesus says, are the ones who are right now feeding folks who are hungry. The ones who are saved are right now welcoming the stranger, even especially when it's dangerous to do so. The ones who are being saved are clothing those who are naked. They're visiting the sick and the prisoners. They're in it. They're doing it. They're living it now because of a deep consciousness that the kingdom has come. If we love, in other words, we're in. This is what we're about. We plant the seeds that one day will grow. We water the seeds already planted, knowing that they hold future promise. We lay foundations that will need further development. We provide yeast that produces effects far beyond our capabilities. We can't do everything. And there's a sense of liberation in realizing this, because it enables us to do something and to do it very well. It may be incomplete, but it's a beginning. It's a step along the way. It's an opportunity for the Lord's grace to enter and do the rest. People of good faith can change systems that have become perverse and wounding. People of good faith can do that when they join together with other people and they organize themselves and their time and their power and their resources and change systems when we know that those systems are now hurting others. We can make them work for human beings again. Because, you know, we've read to the end of the story. We know how this book goes. We know the responsibility that we hold in our hands and the kingdom that those hands are pointing to. We know deep inside us that good triumphs over evil, that life is more powerful than death, that the arc of the universe does bend toward justice, and that love abides. We don't have to travel through time or gaze into a crystal ball to see the rapture. But we do have to build the kingdom if shalom is going to come. We know what the coming of Christ looks like. It looks like you and me working the earth of the heart. It looks like you and me and neighbors and strangers digging into the ground of being, confronting meanness and injustice and betrayal every day if we have to, sowing seeds of healing and reconciliation and community because we have to every day, one person at a time. Amen.